On October 11, 2012, Gigi Amateau came to Writer House to talk about her Portal to the Past, archival research for her novel Come August, Come Freedom, with Brendan Wolfe, managing editor of Encyclopedia Virginia.
I thought maybe how we would start is you could tell us a little bit about the historical background of the book, and I'm interested in knowing why Gabriel, of all the things you could write about.
Sure. Okay. Great. Thank you. Well, thanks for having me here in Charlottesville. It's, I love Charlottesville, and I'm always glad to be part of the Writer House community. So let me just ask you a question. Is everyone here familiar with sort of the basic story of Gabriel's Rebellion and Gabriel's conspiracy? No, so I'm getting a few nods, but mostly shaking of heads no. Well, you know, I find that's the case for a lot of people. To me, it's such a rich and just vibrant part of our Virginia history and the history of our nation. And I think even kind of a little window into a specific moment in the history of the world where we were kind of just swept up with the fever of liberty and freedom. But not many people know about it. I'm sure that I studied it in college because one of my professors who I leaned on for research was Philip J. Schwartz at Virginia Commonwealth University, but I don't remember studying it as a freshman. I skipped a lot of school when I was a freshman, so I probably skipped those days. But even so, I've lived in Richmond since I was 8 years old, but this is not a story that was part of the fabric of my growing up. So I really discovered it, or rediscovered it, I guess, in the late 90s when the county of Henrico put a monument up right behind a bank where I was living in the Bellevue neighborhood. So here's the basic story. There was a young man who was born in 1776. That's an auspicious year if you're a freedom-loving person. He was born on a tobacco plantation called Brookfield Plantation, which was about 2,000 acres in the county of Henrico, about 6 miles north of the capital of Richmond, which had just recently become the capital. It had only moved, the capital had moved from Williamsburg to Richmond during the Revolutionary War because geographically Richmond is a little bit more protected than Williamsburg because you have the falls of the James and the Rapids. And so Gabriel was likely born on Brookfield Plantation. The earliest he's placed there is in 1783. You can kind of do the math backwards, and he would have been about 7 years old. He grew up to become a blacksmith. He was enslaved by Thomas Prosser, the owner of Brookfield Plantation, who had about 50 to 60 enslaved people living and working at Brookfield Plantation. So Gabriel became a blacksmith, so he was a skilled man. He could read and he could write. So there's no real evidence about who taught him to read or write. There's a lot of oral history about that. But primary documents that are from the state tell us that he could read and he could write. Between about 1783, where he shows up on the tax record, and 1799, it's anybody's speculation about what was going on in his life. So that was the opportunity for a fiction writer. In 1799, this young man interacted with the criminal justice system. He and his brother Solomon and a friend who was also enslaved by a man named Nathaniel Wilkinson, who owned the plantation next door, had ventured to a farm that was being rented from Colonel Wilkinson, and they stole a pig. And from hog stealing was kind of a common thing, and as long as you weren't caught doing it, people tended to look the other way. So they stole this pig, these three young men, and they were caught by Absalom Johnson, a farmer who was renting from Nathaniel Wilkinson. And in the moment where they were caught with this pig, Gabriel has this pig under his arm. Words are exchanged between this young man who is a blacksmith, who can read and write, who is clearly a leader in his community, and this man who's a renting farmer. And they started to fight. And his brother and his friend Jupiter are cheering Gabriel on in the middle of the road. And in the moment, Gabriel bites off the ear of Absalom Johnson, the farmer. And then the charges are no longer hog stealing, right? Now the charges brought against him are maiming. So that's the first encounter that you really see in the primary documents, is Gabriel interacting with the criminal justice system on a capital charge of maiming, for maiming the white man, Absalom Johnson. There was a little loophole that was still available to enslaved people at that time called Benefit of Clergy. It was a law that was left over from Great Britain that said if you were charged, if you were a person charged and found guilty of a capital crime in the court system, if you could stand in court and recite a verse from Scripture from your heart, from memory, then your sentence would be commuted. And so this is what Gabriel did. He stood in court and recited a verse from Scripture. So that tells us something about this man, too. What's that?
It would be commuted one time.
That's exactly right. And so this is what he did. He stood up in court and he recited a verse from Scripture. The primary sources don't indicate what the verse was. So there's also room for a fiction writer to make some decisions. And so his sentence was commuted, and he was branded in the web of his left hand in public, in court, with a cross. So he's carrying his criminal record around in his hand. And the purpose of that is so that if he ever interacted again with the criminal justice system, his record would be here. And they would see that he had already taken his clergy. And so that's the first real piece of the second kind of window we have about this young man, that we know he was on Brookfield Plantation when he was 7. He had this encounter with the court system when he was 23. And then what we know is that he planned and very nearly pulled off one of the largest slave rebellions in the history of the U.S. And very early in 1800. So this all occurred with the maiming of Absalom Johnson in the late summer and early fall. He was left in jail, in the Richmond City Jail, for a month and released in November of 1799. And then in 1800, kind of the court documents start to look backwards. And so now I'll tell you about the rebellion. So probably by early 1800 in the spring, Gabriel was recruiting men from around the countryside. And he had clearly had a plan to launch a military attack on the capital. He recruited, by some accounts, thousands of men. By the court document counts, 500 or 1,000. And what was surprising to me in learning more about this era was that there was for men like Gabriel, who were skilled and highly sought after because of their skill as artisans, there was a little bit of mobility. He was moving around the region, as were his colleagues and friends. And this gave him an opportunity to recruit people and recruit men into a plot to basically take Governor James Monroe hostage until he agreed to abolish slavery in Virginia. So they were Gabriel was using formal and informal networks that existed at the time to recruit people, and word was rapidly spreading around the state. So if we look back at the documents, we can see he recruited men from the city of Richmond, from Henrico County, from Hanover County, from Caroline County, from Chesterfield County, from the city of Petersburg, from the county of Suffolk, from the city of Norfolk, from the county of Albemarle, from Cartersville and the county of Cumberland, from Goochland, from Gloucester. So you start to see, how could this happen? They didn't have the internet, right? They were using the systems and the networks that were available to them to recruit into this military plan, this rebellion that, to me, as I read the primary and secondary sources, was very much a rebellion in the tradition of the American Revolution. So the rhetoric that you start to see in the primary documents is what Gabriel and his men were saying to one another is, I can bear what I've borne no more. I can bear this no longer. It's time to rise and fight for our freedom. We have every right to fight for our country as any men. Here are our hands and here are our hearts. And that phrase in particular really struck me, here are our hands, here are our hearts, because I'm sort of, as a reader, really fascinated with the early republic. And if you look at the Court of Discovery, that same phrase, here are our hands, here are our hearts, that's what men were saying when they signed up for the military expedition to go with Lewis and Clark to explore and find the outlet, right, that didn't exist, to the Pacific Ocean. That's how they were, you know, coming to Meriwether Lewis. Here are our hands, here are our hearts. So that phrase, right, that's a rhetoric that was used by patriots and used by people who were recognizing that this was, the freedom was, freedom and being a part of the early American nation was kind of who they were. That was their identity. And so Gabriel recruited men throughout the spring and summer of 1800. His brother Solomon was also a blacksmith. They were forging weapons, running bullets in their forge. Other men were gathering weapons. But they were also listening to what was happening around them in the city of Richmond and making reconnaissance trips into the city to gather the information that they would need to have this military expedition be successful. So a few things that they knew. They knew that the militia had been was not in the city in an active way, that the governor, James Monroe, had asked the militia to send their weapons in to the state for inventory and repair and tagging. And then they knew that the countryside and the city was largely unarmed by the militia. And in fact, James Monroe had started to send the militia's weapons back out into the countryside, depositing them at taverns for the militia to come and pick up. So they knew there were stores of weapons around the region. James Monroe had also ordered a large amount of gunpowder and ammunition from Philadelphia, and that was sitting in the penitentiary, which was newly built but not yet open. And there was a store of weapons at the arsenal on the Capitol Square. So Gabriel's making missions into the city, learning about these things and planning with a lot of other people to attack the city. They knew they didn't need enough arms to really take the city, but what they needed was enough to get to Watson's Tavern to rearm with the militia arms that had been deposited there. They needed enough arms to get to the penitentiary so they could get the ammunition. And they needed enough arms to get to the Capitol, where they had secured an agreement with a gentleman who was also enslaved named Bob Cooley, but he was highly trusted and carried the keys to the Capitol on his person. And he had agreed to leave the arsenal open. That was his contribution to the rebellion. So they needed to get to the arsenal and rearm. And they also had planned a diversion. So one column was going to go to the penitentiary, get the ammo. One column was going to march to Watson's Tavern, rearm, and then march to the Capitol Square. And then a third column was going to march out to Rockets, what we call Rockets Landing, the Rockets section of the city, which was the hardscape there was mostly still wood. And they were planning to set fire to that part of the city as a diversion to draw out any men who would have been in the city who potentially could have caused a battle before they got in. And then their plan was to seize James Monroe hostage, kidnap him until he agreed to abolish slavery in Virginia. There were groups of men in Petersburg and in Suffolk and Norfolk waiting to hear that the rebellion had gotten underway and they were going to join in. So it was really a definitely planned rebellion. They were armed. They had voted as a group to undertake this on the night of August 30th. That was a Saturday. Even while they were planning and finishing up their weapons and running bullets during that day, the afternoon of the 30th, they could see a storm coming from the west, and they actually at first thought that that storm might be to their benefit. And the trial documents say even though they saw the storm, they had intended to carry on. Well, I don't know how Gaston happened here in Albemarle County, but in Richmond in 2004, also on August 30th, that's kind of like weird little historical vortex, right? A tropical storm named Gaston in 2004 just sort of parked itself over the city and dumped about 14 inches of rain very quickly. People died, bridges were washed out. The city was kind of cut off. Even in the neighborhood where I live, bridges were washed out, trees were down. And this is the type of storm that rolled into the region on the night of August 30th, and that's what happened. Flash flooding cut them off, and they understood they couldn't go forward, so they tried to change the plan to be the next night and alert people, not tonight, tomorrow night. And simultaneous to that, two men who had been involved in the plot betrayed the plan. They told a man who owned a farm called Meadow Farm in Henrico. He dispatched word to Governor Monroe, who had been hearing about a conspiracy but not really doing anything. And he took this man, Mosby Shepherd, seriously, dispatched militia. And by the next day, dozens of men were arrested, held in the city jail. Gabriel escaped for about 2 weeks. He was caught in Norfolk, brought back up the James. A throng of people, black and white, marched with him up to the governor's mansion. James Monroe came out, sent Gabriel to the penitentiary. He was the first prisoner to go to the penitentiary. And he was hung on October the 10th, 1800. I think the numbers vary. Like some people say like 26 men of his men were hung. When Tim Kaine pardoned Gabriel and his recruits in 2007, I think the number they mentioned was 36, but Dozens of men were hung, and many more were exported from Virginia. So that's the gist of it. It takes a long time to tell that story, doesn't it? And thank you so much. Good night. Right. I'm sorry. I got to find the... How do you do that short? I'm sorry.
That was good. You should lecture.
Yeah, right. But the thing that really got me, can I just say this one more thing, is in the primary documents, we also learned that Gabriel had a wife, and her name was... The documents say Nanny. I've seen other secondary sources call her Nancy. So we could call her Nan for short. And not only did Gabriel have a wife, but to me, my interpretation of it is she was his helpmate because she knew about the plan and she was involved with him. So she was recruiting and she was telling people kind of what was going to happen and what the instructions were. And on the night where they were trying to roll the plot to the next evening, the evidence showed that Nanny was there too, going from farm to farm, trying to alert people, we're not gathering tonight, we're gathering tomorrow. So that was really the interest for me as a writer because
discovering
it became a love story.
Nan,
yep.
Well, that's my question is, so, I mean, what you just presented us was the result of years of research. But in and of itself, it's not a novel.
Right.
So how do you spend all of that time reading all of this stuff about both Virginia in 1800 and... Gabriel's various appearances in the historical record and the various things that he did or was involved in, and how do you pull out of that a novel? I mean, how do you give us who Gabriel was as opposed to just what he did or tried to do?
I really think that's a great question, and to me that goes back to his wife. So it's not like you need to have any motivation for him. Right, because he was enslaved. The motivation is just inherent in who he was. He wanted his freedom and was demanding his freedom in that same tradition that the men were so familiar with were demanding it. You know, James Monroe, right, liberated the arsenal from Lord Dunmore when he was 18 mm-hmm. years old. That was at the Capitol in Williamsburg. So he was in that same tradition as people who we think of as the great patriots or our founding fathers. But
they were the minority, right? I mean, not everybody is James Monroe, and not everybody was Gabriel.
Right.
I mean, there was only one slave uprising in the history of Virginia that got past the planning stage, and very, very few that ever became as famous, as successful without getting past planning stage as Gabriel. So what made him different?
So, to me, what made him different was the fact that he was literate. He could read and he could write, and that he was a blacksmith. So I think understanding his role in a city, so if we look around the building that we're in, everything that makes this building work would have come from that man, you know, from that artisan in a city. And so I think he has a lot of the qualities just from the little bit that you know of what we have tended to think of as a leader, someone who's exceptional in their trade, someone who's charismatic. And he was, the record says he was probably 6'3 or 6'4. So he was very tall, you know, physically. The stature of him was in that leader kind of mode. That's the way to say it. But I think for me, the way that it becomes fiction, the opportunity for fiction, really for me rests with his wife. And with the picture that you have to sort of like read through the lines of what's in the primary sources, because it's a very male, the whole thing was very male, and that's who was in charge of everything. But if you start to read the trial documents, so men were being arrested at the end of August and into September and thrown in the city jail. And then everyone started testifying against each other. And there were a few men in particular, two guys named Ben and two of the men who had turned the plot in, who were really telling the details of the plot and of the plan. And if you start to read their testimony, the women are present. Families are present in those words that they're saying, you know, that they were meeting to plan the insurrection at Young Spring and other places like that where enslaved people from the region would meet, from the neighborhood, from different plantations in the area, would meet for funerals, for weddings, for worship, for fish fries and barbecues. So the mobility on the weekends, you get this picture of men coming back from the city into the countryside to join their families and saying things like, while the women ate all the fish, we were under the bridge planning. And children were there. And so to me, that was really the key to turning this from facts of a military plan into the fiction of a man who didn't need any other motivation, I don't think, than the fact that he was seeking freedom. But what more was at stake for him, as I interpreted it, was to be a free man with his family, to be able to live with his family and carry on in his trade with his wife, his brothers, maybe his children.
Well, you begin the book with a really memorable evocation of his mother. And you're going to read a little bit of that.
Sure, I would love to. Thank you. So most of the book is written from the perspective of Gabriel, but I don't know if you fiction writers ever have you ever had those characters who just don't really want to talk to you? You know, you have to find another way in. So initially, I think Gabriel was a little bit skeptical. Like, who are you? Why are you writing this? The character, Gabriel. But so I found easier access creatively through his mother and later through his wife. So most of the book does come from Gabriel's perspective, but it's kind of bookended, beginning the story with him as an infant and from the perspective of his mother, and then ending the story from the point of view of his wife. So I'll just read a little bit of this first chapter. Ma believed. Maybe if I stand up, we'd be able to hear me better. Ma believed. One Sunday before sunrise, she headed out early for church at Young Spring with her infant, Gabriel, swaddled and slung across her chest. She walked briskly along the footpath that she and so many others had worn to the creek. Later, Pa would join them for worship, bringing the oldest boy, Martin, while toting the middle one, Solomon. Since Gabriel's birth, Ma kept most of her days at the great house, away from the field, which she was glad to be, but away from her husband, which left her empty. The cook, Kissy, often reminded her to give thanks for Mrs. Prosser, who granted Ma a weekly Sunday reunion, but Ma yearned for more than half a barred morning with her family. Ma did give thanks for her friends. Praise the Lord for Kissy and Old Major, Ma said aloud now as she set her baby down. In her pocket nestled the apple seeds. She had kept them safe and deep in her apron until the captive ground of winter gave way to spring's rightful thaw. The morning smelled of sunshine, new grass, and flowers to come. Before she reached the stream, where all the people from all the quarters would gather to pray, Ma squatted down on the still side of the hill. There at the south end of Brookfield Plantation, she tugged, and the reluctant earth opened enough for her to place the seeds. She could hear the tinkle of the creek beyond the field. When the rain comes, before long, that trickle will be a roar, she thought. Gabriel began to root around for his second meal of the day, and Ma could not help but think of the other hungry babe. Brookfield's infant master, little Thomas Henry Prosser, would need to eat soon, too. The missus could produce no milk of her own, so Ma fed both boys. For times when Ma would be away from the great house, Old Major had fashioned a wooden spout from persimmon wood so that Kissy could feed Thomas Henry the early milk Ma squeezed from herself. If that milk ran out and the little master turned fussy, Kissy would placate him with a sugar tea until Ma returned. The missus rarely asked for her son before noon on Sundays anyway. Praise the Lord for Ann Prosser's Sunday sick headaches. Ma gave thanks for this too. She stretched out long in the grass and nursed her six-month-old son without interruption. After a while, Gabriel opened his walnut eyes, and Ma gave him her other breast. On some Sundays, he got his fair share. Ma stroked Gabriel's troubled brow. Eat all you like, child. Take what's yours. When he finished, Gabriel protested, being wrapped up so tight. He pushed away from Ma with his head, the only part of him unhemmed and unbound. Kissy had warned her not to loosen his dressing. The crude March air might do the child harm. Ma unswaddled her son. Another baby fell fast asleep from such a full little belly. You're wide awake, my Gabriel. She swept him up, then swung him down from the earth to the dawning sky and back. With its tender bare feet brushed along the downy grass, the baby laughed. He tried to stand on his own, and Ma approved. Ho ho! Where are you off to, my strapping boy? You got business at the market? Work in the city? My baby boy, off to the sea? What Ma believed was this. Her youngest son would grow strong and grow free. He would run pick an apple anytime he pleased, even if only to taste the good fruit given by the Lord and see from this spot the amber sunrise painted by his hand. She reflected on the talk so often heard in the quarter and the stories Pa brought back from the city, stories of a people insistent on freedom. Tall tales, she had thought first. Tall tales of a David thinking to slay a giant. Yet Pa had been right all along. Virginia and the other colonies had condemned rule by tyranny and were now at war with England. Ma prayed aloud for the apple seeds and for Gabriel, her youngest born. Lord, set my Gabriel free too. One way or another, set my angel boy free. She kissed the baby in the hollow of his tender neck and refused to bind him up again. The Lord sent a gentle rain that same afternoon and a blessed sunshine the next morning. From the soil once full enough to grow tobacco, now completely spent, God and Ma together helped the apple tree's roots grow strong and its limbs slowly fall on the protected shelf in the hill overlooking the spring. Gabriel grew too.
I would imagine after you've spent a couple of years immersed in your research and learning everything that's in the historical record about Gabriel and all the secondary resources as well, you become kind of wedded to the history in a way. Like, I mean, you become really invested having learned all of that stuff, which takes a lot of work. How do you then separate yourself from that enough to write fiction?
Well, because certain pieces of it just get in the way.
Right, right.
So, and really, you know, every time I read, I love this story so much because it just has politics and love and nature, and it's just everything about it is a fascinating piece of history to me. So even now when I read, like, you know, Michael Nichols has a new book out called Whispers of Rebellion mm-hmm. that came out just as I was going into copy editing with this, so I didn't get to use that as a secondary source, but he has some interesting new things to say, you know, and so I would say there's so much more even still to learn about it, mm-hmm. but as a fiction writer, some pieces get in the way, and so especially so the perspective I was trying to really tell this from was as a family story, a story about a man who loves his wife and who loves his family, and that's really what he's invested in at first, is just creating a different reality for his family, and then he realizes that's not going to happen, and so he pushes to create that different reality for all the families in the region. And there were just some keys to that. So, you know, in the book, I really have, I've cut some people out who are present in the primary sources. There was a co-leader of the rebellion named Jack Bowler, also called Jack Ditcher. He was a different kind of guy than Gabriel. I don't think he was an artisan. He couldn't read and write. And there was a little bit of vying in the primary sources between the two of them at one point about who really would lead the rebellion. And the men voted that Gabriel would be their general. So first, in the first draft, I was really trying to stay kind of true to that and include everybody in the history and all the events. Mm-hmm. But Jack Ditcher got in the way of me trying to tell it as a family story because he's right. having this, like, encounter, this competition with Gabriel, and it was just too much for me. This wasn't Jack Ditcher's story. It was really, I wanted it to be a story about family, but also about a family who is living in this legacy of people resisting and insisting. That's what I was trying to sort of thread through this. And so in some ways it kind of got easy. I mean, it was confusing for me in the first two drafts trying to be really true to everything. Mm-hmm. And so the stronger the character of Nanny, his wife, became, and the stronger the character of his mother became, the more clarity I had around what I could let go of regarding like the military piece of it.
I think that the book wears its history very lightly, which I think is hard to do. I mean, I felt like it felt very, I could tell reading it that you'd done the research, that you'd done your homework about, whether it be about Gabriel or the life of enslaved people, but it didn't feel like it was in the way, and you weren't trying to prove anything to anybody. It was just there, like it was just there in 1800, which I thought was nice. And I also liked the way that you interspersed primary resources in the book. Was that something you did from the very beginning?
Sort of. I did it and then didn't do it and then did it again. Right. Right. So the primary resources, like, what's the problem with the primary resources? What's the big problem? The big problem is they're from a point of view, right? They're from the point of view of the state, of the Commonwealth of Virginia. So there is like a total bias in the primary resources. But they're telling a story of what was occurring. So that's where the facts are. So you kind of have to back out of the bias a little bit. But I thought that because I was telling the story from the perspective of Gabriel and his family, there were certain things that you wouldn't necessarily be able to see unless I let the story also unfold at this other level of kind of unfolding from the status quo. Right. And so there are extracts from the primary documents threading throughout the novel. But then some of the extracts I've fabricated to sort of show the, like, again, to show the legacy of the tradition that Gabriel was, that I think in my interpretation, the tradition that he was living and working in. And so, for example, early in one chapter, so I wanted to surround him in this book. I wanted to surround him with people, men and women, who were committing acts of resistance, large and small, from the beginning, so that this is not something new or unexpected or surprising from him. This is what he does because this is what he has seen, both from the American Revolution unfolding, but also from the community of people around him. So I ended up having to create a lot of fictional characters to kind of show some of these things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we can open it up to questions that people have. A million more questions, so you don't have questions. But is anyone?
Yeah. Now I'm going to be totally embarrassed if it wasn't you who said this, but I think it was when you were here before, you talking about bias, that you said, and I don't remember who it was you read, but the idea of dark and light, and there being a bias about that, and that you kind of rewrote after, and I thought that was really
cool. Well, yeah, thank you for asking that. That's a great question. When Brendan and I talked earlier this week, we kind of talked about the different types of research, so primary research, which was just looking at the documents, and secondary research, trying to become familiar with what historians and other people have said, and commented and interpreted this story over the last 212 years. But then there was this third leg of research that I can't figure out what is the right way to, what do you call this? And it has to do with the question you asked. And this was just research to help me think better, you know, to kind of, like, there's a bias in the trial documents, there's a bias in the official record. Well, there's a bias in me too, you know. I mean, I was born in 1964, I'm a female, I was born in the state of Mississippi, I live in the middle class. I have a bias, whether I recognize it or not. That's what I'm bringing to all of my work. And so part of what I felt like I really needed to do is kind of keep, in addition to researching, kind of keep myself, like, always carving out periods for reflection, sort of critical reflection, and asking myself, have I identified my bias? And then once you have, not that maybe, I don't know, I probably haven't completely, once I've realized something, then the question is, do you keep going with that or do you change who you are? So one example of that is I read James Baldwin's essay, Everybody's Protest Novel, in which he was offering criticism of a Native son and Uncle Tom's Cabin and the tradition of writing slavery protest novels. And he was really being pretty hard on people, on authors who are writing in that tradition or in that genre, I guess. And one of the things he said, I'm paraphrasing, he was more eloquent than I would be. Sort of one of the things he said is, you know, and another thing y'all it's really getting tiring the way you're using the metaphor of color, of black and white. It's so predictable. Black is always evil, bad, and white is always saintly, goodly, and, you know, going toward the light and all of that. And as I was reading that, I was like, whoa, uh-oh. Let me just go back to this draft. And sure enough, that's the bias that I hadn't recognized. But just from being me, and that, for whatever reason, that is how I was writing the first draft. And so without the intention of doing that, as I was using color in my draft, I was applying these subjective values to the color white and to the color black. And so when I read this essay, it was a really fantastic moment just for me as a writer, one, to sort of say, oh, no, that's what I'm doing. And then you have to ask yourself the question, okay, but so, do I want to do that? Does it make sense to do that in this story? Or is there a different way? I mean, it's really basic, the use of color, but the question was, so is there a different way to do this? And if there is a different way, what is it, and does it make sense? So then I thought, well, let me just flip it and see what happens. What happens if I just totally redo it? And so in this story, the metaphorical use of the color black really represents safety and freedom and liberation. And the color white represents sort of this harshness and cruelty and blinding injustice. And that actually, to me, it was a very freeing way to think about the use of color, and it stretched me a little bit. But it completely makes sense. Why does it make sense? Because the guy was a blacksmith, right? He spent all day in the dark with just enough light to see the color of the ore. And so, and we know from the primary sources that in the smithy, that's where he was making weapons, that's where he was planning. And so you can sort of extrapolate that darkness of the forge felt safe. It felt like a place where liberation would kind of come from. So that's probably the most concrete example of that. But it was really invigorating as a writer to sort of go, oh, I'm doing this. I don't have to do this. I can try something different.
Hi, I work at a special collections library, and I'm always interested about how writers go about their research process. So my question is kind of a combination question. What repositories did you go to conduct your research? And what order did you conduct it? Because you talked about secondary sources and primaries.
Right.
What's the order of your research? And
right.
I guess if you can share like a document that was kind of like, that was not an aha moment, one that kind of made you tingle.
Right. Oh, yeah, there are a bunch of those. There are a bunch of those. And so I made some notes just about that exactly. So it was pretty circular. I would say just because of my familiarity with the story was initially from historical markers around Richmond. So secondary sources initially told me the story. And then I really leaned heavily on three sources. And the first thing I did when I decided I really was interested in writing it is I emailed a reference librarian at the Library of Congress, and they're fantastic. And so she or he, I can't remember, really gave me three definitive works. One was Gabriel's Rebellion, the Virginia Slave Conspiracies by Douglas Edgerton. So I read this. Even after I would read the primary sources, I would kind of come back to this for context, as well as James Sidbury's book and Philip J. Schwartz's essays and books. And I just felt pretty free to annotate this with questions and notes. And then the secondary sources also were very helpful to me in identifying where the primary sources were held. Mm-hmm. And then I could kind of make a map or a plan to go and look at those. So I did most of the research for... Now, a lot of the primary sources are online. You know, pieces of them are online with the collection of the Library of Virginia, as well as sort of Harvard published the executive papers of the Commonwealth of Virginia from 1800, a long time ago. So a chunk of the original sources are online in a Google book that is in the public domain. But that doesn't give you the whole of the record. And so just reading through and underscoring the footnotes and the secondary resources helped me to make a plan to go to the Library of Virginia to dig a little bit deeper. So the trial documents, most of those, you can get the gist of the story and read that online. But then some of the other pieces, like the rental agreement between Colonel Nathaniel Wilkinson and the farmer who got his ear bitten off, Absalom Johnson, there was this agreement that outlined the land that would be rented and, you know, who and people that would be rented. And so Jupiter, Gabriel's friend, was part of that rental agreement. And that's not online, but it's referenced in secondary sources. So using the secondary sources to kind of make a map of how I wanted to spend my time at the Library of Virginia. And then both the Library of Virginia and the Virginia Historical Society are really fantastic about having a large amount of their catalog online. Not that you can read it online, but you can sort of give yourself a framework for how you're going to go in and spend your time. So I did use the online catalog searching for the Historical Society, Virginia Historical Society, and Library of Virginia to sort of try to understand what was available on site there and how I wanted to spend my time there. And then for some of the other extracts, like the newspaper articles and things like that, the Colonial Williamsburg Digital History is amazing if you're interested in the colonial and early Republic era. So all of the issues of the Virginia Gazette are online. And so that was a real key piece also for me. Just I spent a lot of time in the Virginia Gazette online at the Colonial Williamsburg. And then, hold on, let me see what else I say in my notes. Let's see, the Colonial Williamsburg. Oh, also at the Library of Virginia. No, the Library of Congress. They have all the Thomas Jefferson letters online there. And those are our primary sources, and while I didn't use a lot of those in the book, and I did in the first draft, I was like, people need to know, this stuff is fantastic. And I was just sort of loading up everything, and then I had to kind of come back and go, yeah, but it's not really part of the story. But, so for example, James Callender was in the jail, and he had been thrown in jail under the Sedition Act during the time when Gabriel's conspiracy was occurring. So he's sitting there in jail, John Adams had him thrown in jail, and all of Gabriel's men are also in the same jail, so he's writing these eyewitness accounts of what's happening back to Thomas Jefferson. So you get some little nuggets of the story there, like he makes some editorial comments on how barbaric Thomas Henry Prosser was. He was the young man who had inherited Brookfield and was born actually in the same year that Gabriel was born, so it's not tough for a fiction writer to extrapolate that the two boys might have played together when they were little. But James Callender is making this commentary on the character of Thomas Henry Prosser. So then you can, as a fiction writer, sort of take the fact that he's telling Thomas Jefferson that Thomas Henry Prosser is barbaric. And you can, for me, I felt pretty free to use that to inform me as I was drawing the character. But then, so that was the public record, right? The public historical record. There's also a lot of oral history. And then there's sort of private pieces. So there are two pieces of research that were kind of like bone-chilling for me. And one was when I was at the Library of Virginia for the first time really reading on the microfilm, reading the actual trial documents. And I came to the trial of Solomon, and that was Gabriel's brother, maybe younger, maybe older, but they seemed to be doing a lot together, so maybe they were the same age. And he was also a blacksmith, Solomon. So Solomon was found guilty and sentenced to death. And a few days later, I don't know, maybe he panics, but he tells the jailer he wants to confess. So there's a confession in the hand of the man who is taking it. And so you're reading these words that Solomon, his brother, is saying from jail. And the first thing he says is, "It was my brother Gabriel who convinced me to do this." And your heart just sinks because you don't know the motivation. But that made me really sad. Like, that made me really just cry. And then I spent most of the time I was researching, like, really jacked up about Pharaoh Shepherd. That was one of the men who turned Gabriel in. Like, I spent most of, because Gabriel was my main hero. And I'm speaking as a fiction writer, not really commenting now on the history. So he was my hero, my guy that this whole thing is about. So I stayed pretty, like, ticked off at Pharaoh Shepherd, who turned him in. You know, I mean, I had to kind of keep myself, like, you know, sort of, because he was the reason that my guy didn't get what he wanted in the work of fiction. And I went out to a private home in Hanover County. A descendant of the Tinsley family has lived in this land since the mid-1700s, and you walk into the parlor, and it is amazing. She has diaries from the mid-1700s all the way through the 1800s, blacksmith logs, logs of births of slaves on their land. The land has changed very little. So I spent a whole entire afternoon there, and I wasn't really looking for anything related to Gabriel, but I wanted to get, this was a farm that was just a few miles east of Brookfield Plantation, about the same size, doing the same kind of things. And so I wanted to get a feel for the rhythm, right, of what was happening here. How were people talking about it who lived there? And something happened when I was finished, and the woman who was so gracious to let me be there, she had to run off and find her dog. And the only book left that I hadn't been through was a tax record for Hanover County from 1814. And I thought, well, you know, that's only 14. Let me just flip through here and see, do I know any of these people? And there, some of them are showing up that were, you know, on the court and justices here and there and landowners. And on the very last page was a page called Overseers of the Poor. And I looked down at the end, and in 1814, there is Pharaoh Shepherd. And he's the man who turned Gabriel in. And in exchange for turning the plot in, the state of Virginia freed him and gave him his freedom. And I sort of softened a little bit there because I realized that Pharaoh had gone on. He wasn't a landowner, but he owned he owned property. He was farming, and he had done a lot. He had challenged his former owners in court and won. So he was a man who was using the systems that were there for citizens, for free citizens. He was using those systems. He purchased his son's freedom through an agreement with Mosby Shepherd, but it came at this weird time where the Commonwealth had already passed a law that said any slave who was freed or manumitted would have to leave the state within a year, and his son's time comes up, right? So he basically convinces men of Henrico to put a bill in for him to have an exception so his son can stay, and he wins. So it's hard to stay angry at this man, you know? And then ultimately that little piece of Pharaoh led to just a fantastic kind of email exchange and conversation with Philip J. Schwartz that was incredibly helpful to me in finding just a few little pieces of the primary sources that I hadn't been able to find on my own. So in some ways that was a very moving moment for me to kind of let go of, as a writer, like let go of my need to have anybody in the story be a villain, you know, because I felt like Pharaoh had kind of gave me entree to something I hadn't found.
Thank you
for that question.
Yeah. Can you talk about the latitude, how much latitude you can take in fabricating things about secondary historical figures? In this case, it would probably be Madison.
Monroe, excuse me. Right. Well, that's a really great question, too. And I didn't really fabricate very much about James Monroe. In the end, at the beginning, I really did in the first few drafts, because when Gabriel was captured in Norfolk, he told the people who captured him that he didn't want to, that he had plenty to tell, but he was only going to tell the governor, going to tell James Monroe. So they brought him back to Richmond, and the record doesn't really speak to whether he actually had that audience with James Monroe. And at the very beginning, I wanted him to have that audience, you know. I wanted to see what, and I did. I wrote it out, and I was like, go ahead, yes. And but then I kind of ended up feeling like that was, again, like Jack Ditcher, it was detracting from what I was trying to do in terms of really making this be a story about this man's longing for his family and for everybody in America to have a... I'm getting a little bit... meta, I think, at this point, right? But, you know, he was trying to build this coalition, I think, from the evidence. He was trying to involve free black people. They had, Sam Bird, one of his colleagues, had made this effort to involve the Catawba tribe. And so you get the sense that he had an understanding that there were a lot of people who had been left out of the promise of the revolution. So with some of the secondary historical figures, like James Monroe, I didn't really take a lot. I kind of cut that out. But, for example, with the men who owned
Brookfield Plantation, Thomas Prosser, and his son, Thomas Henry Prosser, I took a lot of latitude. You know, I didn't. I knew some basic facts about them, that they owned Brookfield Plantation, and during what period. I knew that the older Thomas Prosser had some, he was a colleague of Patrick Henry's. His son was named Thomas Henry. At least one of the historians had speculated he may have named his son after Patrick Henry. They worshipped at the same place. So I took those sort of facts and then tried to create the character kind of around that.
In this week's New Yorker, there's a profile of the historical novelist Hilary Mantel, and on the first page of this profile, the writer speaks of historical fiction as being the strange kind of middle ground between fiction and history, and I feel like both of those things are pulling on you as a writer at any given time, and I'm speculating that the urge to put Gabriel in the same room as James Monroe is pushing your writing more toward history and farther away from fiction, or at least from the values that guide fiction versus the values that guide history, the big men, big events.
Right.
But what does it have to do with Gabriel and the story of Gabriel as opposed to the larger story of the United States and the big men? Does that make any sense?
I gotta think about that for a minute.
It strikes me as a novelist, mm-hmm. I imagine, as someone who's interested in the history, I can see the impulse of wanting to get Gabriel in the same room as someone like James Monroe.
Right.
But as a novelist, that might not always be the right decision.
No, I think that's right. And so I think that's exactly right. And I think that's why I kind of cut it out, because what I was trying to draw was this line of him being very focused on a specific thing, and that was initially securing his freedom for his wife and for his family, but then on behalf of everybody who was sort of left out. And this audience with Monroe, given the constraint of history that I was faced with, that it's inevitable what's going to happen. Like, the one thing he really wanted, I couldn't give him that. I couldn't give him that. At the end, he had to be hung on the gallows at 15th Street. That's it. I already knew the ending. And so the conversation, I think, from a fiction writer, that conversation wouldn't have done anything to change that outcome. It wouldn't have moved anything forward. It would have just gone off on a different direction. So I think that you're right.
We have time for maybe one more question.
Did you use any specific tools to organize all of this research?
Say that again?
Did you use specific tools to organize all of this research?
I did, yeah. Yeah, so first I just was using a three-ring binder, and it was just like way too linear, you know. And then I ended up setting up, creating just my own wiki, a private wiki, because I needed to be able to jump in and come out and jump in and come out and link to things. So I definitely used a private wiki. I used Delicious a lot just to bookmark things and hold them until I could get back to them. I used EasyBib. We did not have that when I was in school, and it's amazing. So I used EasyBib to organize my bibliography and my reading list. And then I also have, I've also used Pinterest to board some of the historical markers and some of the, to kind of catalog all of the fiction and nonfiction that treats this story that I'm aware of. Those are the big ones. Let's see. I think that's pretty much it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.